Okay, today is Thursday, October 17th. We're going to get started with chapter 11 that's found on page 92. Do y'all use YouTube to help you study? Sometimes? Okay. This website here, getbodysmart.com, is a good one if you need a little extra help. They do not take it from such a complicated level, which is good because sometimes they add details and videos that, you know, may not be necessary. The nervous system information on there and the neurophysiology information on there can be very helpful as we work through this chapter. Just wanted to throw that out. I think you will be pleased to see how much the nervous system overlaps with the muscular system because we've actually covered part of the nervous system's job. That entire excitation event, that's all nervous system. Okay, so we're going to actually tie that into our conversation once again in this chapter. But to lay the foundation for how the nervous system operates, I wanted to show you this image. It does come from page 92 in your course pack. You actually have branches of the nervous system based on either their structures or their functions. And I'm first going to start you off with a structural classification. So on the bottom of your worksheet, you'll notice that the central nervous system, or CNS, has a blank. And the structures that are found there are the brain and spinal cord. All right, so brain and spinal cord are the two main structures we find in the central nervous system. In the peripheral nervous system, or PNS, what do we find there? Nerves, right. So we can call them cranial nerves and spinal nerves. All right, so for the PNS, the structures we find there are cranial nerves and spinal nerves. So I'll show you this picture. The brain is, of course, in the cranial cavity in our skull, and the spinal cord is housed inside the intervertebral foramen in the spine. So both are housed in a bony protection. You know, a lot of us say that the brain is like where all the decisions are made, but the spinal cord actually does a very good job in making a lot of decisions that don't necessarily have to involve the brain. You know, sometimes people have an accident or an injury and the brain and spinal cord are separated from each other, and we can retrain the spinal cord, not the brain, to teach somebody how to walk. So the spinal cord's got kind of its own heft and its own right. It has a very important function, but in terms of the functions of the brain and spinal cord, our next box there, what would you say the job is of the brain and spinal cord? Processes. Good. So it's a processing center for senses. What else does it do? Good. Okay, so we got processing senses, dictates motor output. Anything else to add? I might just jot down it makes decisions. So I would also jot down CNS makes decisions. Let's talk about your peripheral nervous system, which is, you know, mainly these nerves that travel down your arms and legs, and the ones that branch off of our brain surface. Those cranial nerves and spinal nerves are kind of like the tattletales of your body. Not only are they picking up on everything that's happening in your body and carrying it back to spinal cord and brain for processing, but they're also carrying out the demands of the brain and spinal cord. So all that motor control has to travel either through a cranial nerve or a spinal nerve. So I would not say that making decisions is a process housed in your spinal or cranial nerves, but what I would say is that your spinal and cranial nerves carry sensory information carry sensory information to the CNS and what else? Good, carries out motor functions. Carries out motor functions. All right, so carries sensory information to the CNS and carries out motor functions. So structurally, we have two systems. We have the central nervous system, which is brain and spinal cord. We have the peripheral nervous system, which is cranial nerves and spinal nerves. So the CNS and PNS, those are considered structural classifications or, you know, categories of how the nervous system works. In terms of functionality, we actually have another way to break this down. So when we talk about sensory input, we say that we have an afferent or sensory division. We use those cranial and spinal nerves to carry information from your skin, from your body. This could be both voluntary and involuntary areas that you may or may not consciously feel. So the sensory receptors transmit information by way of cranial and spinal nerves, and that goes back into your central nervous system for processing. That looks like a pretty straightforward pathway, right? You feel, you have senses like your sight, your sounds, all that comes through the sensory pathway. But look at this motor division, how much more complicated that is. Motor output is divided into two separate pathways. You'll notice that one pathway is carried out by a somatic nervous system branch, and the other pathway is carried out by an autonomic nervous system branch. The difference between that is what you're consciously aware of and consciously can control versus what you certainly have no conscious control over. So what are some types of conscious movements that you can control? Yeah, skeletal muscles moving, this whole process we just went through, right? So you can consciously control your skeletal muscles. That is controlled by your somatic nervous system. And so the effector, in other words, what we're targeting are those skeletal muscles. Now, inside your body, you've got all these glands and organs that you don't have conscious control over. And that is what we consider to be controlled by an autonomic nervous system pathway. What we mean by that is it's an automatic pathway that you don't have to consciously think about. That's great news, because if you had to consciously think about your heart beating and breathing and digestion of food and urine being moved, you'd never be able to sleep. You'd be spending all your waking moments thinking about everything else that shouldn't necessarily need to be consciously driven. So there are two branches there, parasympathetic and sympathetic, and you'll see that these targets are things like smooth and cardiac muscles and glands. This may feel a little overwhelming right now. There's a lot to this image. This is not what we're doing right now. We're going to come back to that over chapters 12, 13, and 14. All this is just a cursory overview to how the nervous system is set up. What I'm going to focus on in this chapter is actually not any of this, but rather how nerves transmit nerve impulses. And then chapters 12 will cover central, and 13 and 14 will break down that peripheral nervous system. So, you know, if this feels kind of foreign right now, don't worry, we'll definitely come back and hit this multiple times before we get through the end of all of the nervous system stuff. All right, so let me finish that chart on the bottom of page 92 for you. Under the peripheral nervous system, it says, are there any functional subdivisions of this system? Well, here's peripheral nervous system, and there's your two functional subdivisions, somatic and autonomic. Basically, somatic controls voluntary events. So that's our very last bottom right box. The somatic system controls voluntary events. What does autonomic control? Involuntary, right. So somatic controls voluntary, autonomic controls involuntary. Right. So there's two functional subdivisions here, somatic and autonomic. Somatic controls voluntary events. Autonomic controls involuntary events. And just to kind of tie this back into the big picture, there is yet another function of your peripheral nervous system besides motor control, and that's that sensory transmission process that we look at too. So we've got two things going on here. We've got sensory and motor. Motor can be divided into somatic and autonomic. Okay, so you may want to jot that down as well, that there is also a sensory versus a motor function for the PNS. Okay, so one more thing to add to those boxes down there. Functionally, peripheral can also be notated as sensory and motor. So that's one division set. Another division set is somatic and autonomic. All right, so any questions on that page? Let me take you to the top of page 93, just a review of those functions of the nervous system. You'll notice that sensory input is sometimes called afferent with an A. Motor output is sometimes called efferent or efferent. I sometimes purposely say efferent just so that we can emphasize that the word begins with an E. So afferent nerve impulses are sensory in nature. Efferent or efferent sensory impulses are motor in nature. Okay, so just want to clarify those terms there. Number one, let's talk about sensory input. Where do you have receptors in your body? Have them in your skin, good. Anywhere else? Muscles, good. Okay, so we've got sensory receptors that are kind of like tattletales. They're sitting in our skin. Even our glands and our muscles have those sensory receptors. And so they pick up information and carry it through these nerves back to our brain. So the sensory information may carry either through cranial nerves or through spinal nerves. Are the cranial and spinal nerves part of your central nervous system or your peripheral nervous system? Peripheral, yeah. So that impulse, that sensory impulse is being carried to brain and spinal cord over those cranial and spinal nerves. All right, so at the top there, you've got a couple of blanks. You could add skin, muscles. You could even include glands. Okay, skin, muscles. You could also include glands. So let's talk about a process we've covered before. Back in an earlier chapter, skin, we talked about what happens when you're cold. If you're cold, you pick up on that sensation of temperature through receptors in your skin. Well, we're going to carry that information to our spinal cord by way of sensory receptors and neurons. The spinal cord is then going to relay that information to your brain. So what does your brain and spinal cord do with information that says, I'm too cold? You should shiver, yeah. So the information about you should shiver will now come back out, probably these spinal nerves, and we come to your skeletal muscles with the message that you should shiver. So of course you shiver as long as you're cold until you heat your body temperature back up. So that's how we operate with motor output. Motor output carries a message, typically to muscles and glands, and the message may be to shiver or contract or relax or whatever the case may be. But that motor output is carried there once again by those peripheral nerves. So number three, stimulating motor output. The message is carried to muscles and glands. Muscles and glands. Let's do this another way. Let's say that you're too hot. Skin receptors pick up on that. Those are sensory receptors. They carry the input over spinal nerves to your spinal cord and your brain. What decision does your brain and spinal cord make about being too hot? Sweating, yeah. Message comes back out through these motor nerves and probably going to travel through one of these spinal nerves here. And the message doesn't go this time to muscles, but rather to a sweat gland. And so as long as you're too hot, this message gets relayed from sensory nerves to the central nervous system out through motor nerves, telling those sweat glands to produce sweat. So when do we finally shut off these mechanisms? Yeah, homeostasis when you're normal, right? So these mechanisms cut on when something's out of what we say is normal. And as long as we're out of range, then the mechanism operates. Once you're good to go, mechanism shuts off. Do you know what kind of feedback loop this is? It is negative. Yeah, so it's a negative feedback loop for these two mechanisms. Okay, so those are just two examples of how these sensory and motor outputs link up with your CNS. Do you have any questions about this type of loop? Okay. Why don't we head to the next topic? It's kind of a change of pace. All right, so back in chapter 4, when we talked about nervous tissue, we simply said then there were two types of cells associated with nervous tissue. Do you recall those cells? Yeah, neurons and neuroglia, good. All right, so on your sheet there, you'll notice there's neurons listed first. Neurons are cells that typically live a long time. They do conduct nerve impulses, and they lose the ability to divide. So fantastic cells got this capacity for long life, but they don't divide. So what does that mean? They don't undergo what process? Mitosis. So if you damage a neuron, right? Okay, so in terms of the animal world, not all animals operate the same way. If you think about a salamander or a lizard, sometimes they get their tails lobbed off by a predator coming after them. And, you know, give them some time and that tail grows back. Nerves, muscles, everything grows back in that tail. If we only had that kind of capacity, we would not have to have things like paralysis when a nerve is damaged. So there is research out there going on about how can we tap that? How can we make that work for us? So not all animals have this feature of those neurons stopping dividing and never being able to repair themselves. There is a certain amount of plasticity in our neurons. Up until about age 16, neurons seem to be able to repair and regrow to some extent. But after your mid-teenage years, there is really a loss of that plasticity. So ultimately, that means any nerve damage done after that age is going to be probably permanent. So interesting that we have a capacity for some of that nerve regrowth for a certain period of time. Let's see, we've got sensory neurons first. Are sensory neurons carrying information to or from your CNS? To, good. Are they called afferent or efferent? Afferent, right, they're going to. You'll notice a couple of types listed there. Some of those types of cells can be interoceptors. I'll tell you the easy thing to do is look at that prefix. intero means they're embedded where? Yeah, like inside your body, right? So you'll notice the examples are internal systems, their taste and pressure and pain receptors. So interoceptors are the ones inside your body. What about extero? Where does that tell you? Outside. So whatever's happening externally, like, you know, external environment, things like temperature and touch, sight, smell, and hearing are considered exteroceptors. So they're outside, picking up outside world information. And really cool proprioceptors, where are they found? Muscles, good. So they're in the joints and in the muscles. You ever get on a merry-go-round and somebody spins you like crazy? Not only when you get off do you feel drunk and dizzy like you might vomit, but what happens to your muscles in your body? Do you feel you're anticipating the move of the merry-go-round? Okay, those are proprioceptors. So if you ride in a car for a really long time and you feel like that when you get out of the car you're still riding, or if you ride a merry-go-round, or even if you're in a sloshy ocean, you know, if you sit in the ocean for a while and the waves slosh you back and forth, if you get out and you still feel like, God, I feel like I'm being sloshed by the ocean still, those are proprioceptors anticipating that motion or movement. Sea legs, yeah. You still feel that wobbliness, exactly. Little kids who are clumsy and growing up and, you know, they bang and bruise themselves constantly, that's because as your body gets longer and taller, those proprioceptors have to adjust to a different location. So, you know, if you've got kids or if you yourself were clumsy as a kid, you just knew that you were growing when you all of a sudden, you know, run into the doors and hit your legs on tables. So as you reach adulthood and the body stops changing size, then your body, your proprioceptors become used to where they should be, sensing that joint is located. When they do an inebriation test, when somebody is stopped for drunk driving, if somebody closes their eyes, you know, we know where our elbow joint and face is, yeah. So that is proprioceptors. And if you're drunk, proprioceptors don't always work just right. So they're really cool in terms of telling you where your body parts are in space. Don't have to have your eyes open. Your proprioceptors tell on you. So really cool what they do. All right, so where are interneurons, number two? Only found? Yeah, central nervous system. So that's a short line. You may jot it as CNS. Only found in the central nervous system. Okay, so let's talk about our example. Let's talk about maybe temperature once again. If you have a sensation of being cold, these skin receptors are picking up on the cold temperature on your skin. They carry that information by way of a sensory neuron. It's afferent with an A. It's going toward your central nervous system. And here we arrive in the central nervous system, and I know that because I've got an interneuron. Let's say that we've gone to the brain. And so this sensory neuron has one message only, and it's, I'm cold. The sensory neuron doesn't make decisions. Keep in mind, it's just a tattletale. It just tells the brain what's going on. The brain, however, says, well, I'm cold. What should I do about it? I should turn on what? Shivering. So the decision is made when these interneurons communicate with each other, and then the message is sent back out one of these motor neurons to those skeletal muscles. So the interneurons are the only ones making decisions and communicating, and you'll notice they are found between an incoming sensory neuron and an outgoing motor neuron. Sometimes the pathway is really complicated. You know, this only shows one interneuron, but oftentimes there's really complex pathways with lots of interneurons. Okay, so note their other names. Sometimes they're called association or associated neurons or integration, which is a great word, integration neurons. So let's use our cold example. If you're cold, those sensory receptors pick up on the information. That information is carried to your brain or spinal cord. The brain or spinal cord only contains the interneurons, and what is their job? Yeah, connect to that outgoing motor pathway. So they make decisions, they get that incoming sensory info, they dictate that outgoing motor info. So here we go. If you're cold, that message comes back out with a job for those skeletal muscles to shiver. So right now we're going to tell those skeletal muscles it's time to shiver. Okay, so it's just a loop pathway. It comes in through sensory, the message goes out through motor. That feel pretty comfortable? It is a negative feedback, yeah. All right, so we've talked about neurons. We know there's motor, there's sensory, and there's interneurons. We know that they can conduct impulses, but they do lose the ability to divide and repair themselves. And because they do lose the ability to divide and repair, we have to protect and insulate them using nerve glue, and that nerve glue is called neuroglia. So neuroglial cells are important because they serve a variety of functions for your nervous system. So neuroglia, by contrast, support your neurons. They never lose the ability to divide, and they cannot conduct the nerve impulse. That's not their function. So if you've heard of people having brain cancers, which is more common than something like a spinal cord tumor, brain cancers arise in the neuroglial cells most commonly because they are the ones that never lose the ability to divide. I wouldn't necessarily expect neurons to go through a tumor process because they're the ones that shut down division at some point. So neuroglial cells are the ones that oftentimes produce those tumors. So let's talk about supporting cells in your central nervous system first. Microglia are first. And I've underlined for you some keywords to help this make sense. Their job is to fight infections. So microglia are on patrol. They do help clean up your nervous system. They're the immune system's arm in the brain and spinal cord, and they're cleaning up the areas. Okay. The next type of support cell in your central nervous system is called an astrocyte. Keep in mind that prefix astro is a great clue. What does that tell you? Star. Yeah, it's kind of a star-shaped cell. And you'll notice it has a lot of different functions. One of them is to bind and brace neurons together, so it's kind of like a glue that helps to form the structure of your brain and spinal cord. It also forms a blood-brain barrier between your capillaries and the neurons. So you may know that your brain is not accessible by all medications. In fact, only certain medications can access your nervous tissue. That's because these astrocytes form an impenetrable barrier between your blood vessels and the brain tissue. So if you didn't have astrocytes, what would happen to everything that was in your bloodstream? It'd go through your brain, right. We have an organ that filters everything. Those are your liver, your kidneys. We do not want your brain to be a filter. That means bacteria, viruses, cancer cells, anything that's riding in your bloodstream would have access to your brain tissue. So this is meant to be a good thing. It's meant to be a barrier between anything and everything in your bloodstream having access to your brain tissue.
Firewall,
that's a great way to put it. Good. So you may have heard of glioblastomas. Some people have these. They're brain cancers, and they're actually a cancer of the astrocytes. Oh boy, look at this long word here, oligodendrocytes. Okay, so these are very cool cells. And if you were to think about how a roll of toilet paper works, you know, you've got a tube in the middle, right? And then the paper wraps around and around and around. Paper towel roll works the same way. That's exactly how an oligodendrocyte wraps around a nerve fiber in your central nervous system. So it insulates and protects that nerve cell. So I think of this kind of just like a roll of toilet paper, roll of paper towel. It's a wrapping around and around that insulates and protects those nerve fibers. So in your brain, you've got white matter and gray matter. Which one do you think is composed of oligodendrocytes. White matter, yeah, just like a roll of white toilet paper, that white matter in your brain is wrapped by oligodendrocytes. So we'll talk more about the function of these. They're actually great for helping increase nerve impulse transmission speed. All right, the last type of cell in our central nervous system that we're going to discuss is an ependymal cell. And you actually have fluid that circulates in your brain and spinal cord. You don't have to do anything for it to circulate. You don't even have to move for it to circulate. There are cilia on these ependymal cells that create a current that circulates your brain and your cerebrospinal fluid. So here you can see, right on top, there's cilia. It is their job to sweep along and move along that cerebrospinal fluid and let it circulate inside your brain, outside your brain, and up and down your spinal cord. So they are the ones that help to circulate that cerebrospinal fluid. Okay, so if you have trouble remembering those four cells, you may want to flashcard them. I've underlined for you some really good keywords to keep straight. And it's easy to keep straight the last two cells here in your peripheral nervous system. You'll notice that they are S words, satellite and swan cells. These are bodyguards, okay? So you've got protective cells in your peripheral nervous system. The satellite cells protect the cell body. And we may not have used that word before, but I should mention the cell body is where the nucleus is housed. And so we definitely want to protect the brain of the cell, the neuron. So satellite cells wrap the cell bodies. The swan cells are also like bodyguards. They're protectors once again, and they are formed exactly like oligodendrocytes. The only difference is swan cells are the myelin sheath wrappings in your peripheral nervous system, as opposed to oligodendrocytes, which are found only in which system? Yes, central. So just want to keep those two words straight. Oligodendrocytes make the myelin sheath in your CNS. Swan cells produce the myelin sheath. Swan cells produce this wrapping called a myelin sheath in your peripheral nervous system. Okay, so a myelin sheath is kind of like a wrapping, and we'll talk about that a little bit on page 94. How about questions on this page? Not the most exciting page, right? All right, page 94 has a cell for you to take a look at. This is a neuron. And I've got a motor neuron pictured at the very bottom of your page. It is called a multipolar neuron, but it also is a motor neuron. All right, so this is traditional multipolar neuron structure. There's other kinds of neurons called unipolar. Some cells are called bipolar, but this multipolar neuron is what we oftentimes talk about in this course when we think about nerve cells or neurons. And if you use your imagination, I think it looks like a tree. You've got the tree branches up top. You've got a tree trunk. And down below, you've got these tree roots. And so if you think about a cell as a tree, it kind of helps you understand the naming scheme for these parts here. Let me start you with number one, the cell body. The cell body contains the nucleus of your cell. This is a neuron. Okay, so up here is our cell body. That nucleus is housed inside the cell body. You know, this is where the business of the cell occurs. This is where any processing that must take place is going to happen in that cell body. You'll notice a long extension coming away from that cell body. That long extension is called what? That's called our axon. Okay, and in a multipolar neuron, there's typically one that leads away from the cell body. And I keep it straight because axon with A tells me it's leading away from your cell body. And that is the direction the nerve impulse will travel. Nerve impulses travel from your cell body along the length of the axon. We never go the other direction. We never go backwards from axon to cell body. We always, always travel cell body away along that axon. Okay? Sometimes these axons can be really long, like in your legs. It can be 3 or 4 feet in length. So, you know, the entire length of your leg has an axon running down to the foot. So that's an incredibly long axon that if damaged, you've got problems from that damage point all the way beyond. The place where your axon connects to your cell body has a name. It's called the axon hillock. You'll notice that word is bolded there. Axon hillock is where your axon and cell body join together. So it's this area right around here. All right, and the bud-like endings, what are they called? Axon terminals, good. All right, so for the function, the axon always conducts information away from your cell body. We know those axon terminals release a neurotransmitter, that's our blank. They release a chemical called a neurotransmitter. That blank is neurotransmitter. All right, so we've got the cell body, the axon terminals taken care of, but you know, the big part of this cell body has all these branches coming off of it. These branch-like endings up here are our next term. They're called dendrites. And the word dend, that prefix, actually means tree. So you can see how someone must have thought they look like tree branches. In reality, they're like satellite dishes. They're out there looking for any kind of incoming message. And so you can send a message to any one of these, and it will be transmitted to the cell body, down the axon into the axon terminals, and on to the next cell. So I think of these dendrites as receiving incoming information. They're like screaming, hey you know, you got anything for me? They're out there looking for any kind of synapse that might carry information to the rest of that cell. So the pathway of a nerve impulse we can now map from dendrites to cell body to axon. Of course, we end up with those axon terminals and then hop on to the next cell. I probably need a little more than a few minutes to do myelin sheath, so why don't we start with number 4? And then I want you to look where we're going on Tuesday, 95. 96, 97, 98, and then I've got the pages repeated, 99, 100, 101. This is all a repeat of excitation. I'm going to add a little detail into it, but it's just a rerun of where we've already been. Okay, so you may want to look ahead to where we're going.